Well, you should see on the screen the title of this afternoon's session, Equipping the Next Generation for the Battle. And as I've prepared for this week, I've been thinking that maybe we should change one of those words. Maybe instead of equipping for the battle, we should have said equipping for the war. There's this old proverb about winning the battle and losing the war. And we've been talking about some of those battles today and yesterday, battles over the historicity of Adam, battles over the age of the earth, battles over theistic evolution. And I want, as we wrap things up today, to step back and think a little bit about the larger war that we're fighting. Does the next generation even really understand the overall war? And if not, how can we win it? So let's start here. Very fundamentally, who is our enemy? And I want to ask you this afternoon, is the enemy science? People talk about a battle between the Bible and science. Is that actually our enemy? And it depends on how you define the word science. If by science you mean atheistic naturalism, then yes, that's an enemy to a Christian worldview. But I'm not eager to let the world redefine the word science that way. I like to think of science as the study of nature, particularly as a Christian, the study of God's created world. And if that's what you mean by the word science, then science actually is not the enemy. The enemy is Satan. He's the god of this world. And he would love to redefine science to turn it into our enemy. But it's not actually the enemy. So I want to start with this question. How does science actually fit into your worldview? I mean, very practically, when you turn on the news and the reporter starts talking, and the story is that today scientists announced, what kind of thoughts come to your mind? When you sit next to someone on an airplane and they say, oh yeah, I'm a research scientist, I'm kind of asking you personally, how do you feel about science? What's your attitude about science? How does science fit in your worldview? And that's important because I want to take it a step farther and ask, what are we teaching the next generation about science? How does science fit into their worldview? And could it be that we're passing down to them fundamentally an improper view of what science is in the first place? And how can we ever fight these battles, and how can we win this war if we are confused about science? So I put in your notes there three different attitudes that we might accidentally pass down to the next generation that I think would be a problem. Do we have a generation of young people that are afraid of science, that are intimidated by science, that see it as an evil, as something suspect? Are we cowed by the claims of science? Is that what we've communicated to the next generation? Science is something to be afraid of. Or are we just ignorant of science? Have we communicated to the next generation that it really doesn't matter? You don't need to know this stuff. Ken Ham was arguing that we, of all people, probably should know more about evolution than the average layman does. My kids were talking about this the other day. Which came first, the Cenozoic or the Paleozoic? And does it matter if we know the answer to that question? Maybe we, of all people, should actually know the answer to that question. Have we communicated to the next generation that it's okay just to be ignorant about science? Or maybe the word is apathetic. Is it something that's just irrelevant? It doesn't matter what you know. It doesn't matter what you think. It's fine. Just don't worry about that. Focus on more important things. Well, our focus always ought to be to go to the Bible. And I raise the question now, what does the Bible say about how science fits into our worldview? And what you find when you investigate that question is that the Bible speaks very positively about science. I don't know of a single verse where science itself is somehow presented as some kind of enemy in the Bible. And when I say that, there might be a verse that pops into your mind. There is 1 Timothy 6:20 that talks about the oppositions of science, falsely so-called. But as many of you would know, the word science in that verse is just a form of the Greek word gnosis, or knowledge. It's not science in the sense of God's created world. And it says false science. Science falsely so-called. So there's no basis there to say that science itself is our enemy. So I say that the next generation needs foundationally a proper perspective on science and how it fits into a Christian worldview. So we're going to go to the Bible, and what I have today is just a brief Bible study. on some of the ways that the Bible factors science into its theology. I have four simple points. None of them are novel. Several of them we've heard about through the conference today. And I think the help for us is in putting all of these together. I think that just thinking through these together, putting them all on the same page, so to speak, helps us get an overall perspective on how does God think about science? How does the Bible present science? How are we supposed to think about science? How does it fit in our worldview? So here's point A, and I've titled this Creation as Vocation. By creation, I don't mean the event, the act of creation. I mean the result of creation. I mean the natural world that God created. And to the extent that science is the study of creation, you could substitute the word science there. You could talk about science as vocation. But vocation is a bit of an old word. We don't use it very much. But the root of that word is just from a word that means a calling, and we use the word calling in this sense. A vocation was something that God called you to. That might be the career that you're in. You are a pastor by vocation. We also tended to use that as different roles that you played in life. If you are a wife or a husband, you have the vocation of being that. If you are a parent, parenting is a vocation, the way that people used to use this word. I'm suggesting that creation is a vocation. And we find that, first of all, in this key passage in Genesis 1:28. Where God tells mankind, Adam particularly, to subdue the earth and to have dominion. This is sometimes called the creation mandate or the dominion mandate. And I put those words in quotation marks because they come with a little bit of theological baggage. Theologians argue about the extent of that mandate. At one extreme, there are some people that are arguing that they see in that verse a political mandate to take over politics and establish an American theocracy. There are people that say they see in that verse a cultural mandate to take over and dominate Hollywood and turn it into a Christian culture. That's one extreme. At the other extreme, there are people that argue that we don't, and in fact can't, have any dominion even over nature. They say that God is actually not commanding anything here, that this is actually not a mandate. That's a pretty big spread of opinion. And answering the question, the extent of the mandate, involves going into the fall and how that's changed the situation. And what I really want to do today is leave that debate to the theologians. Having acknowledged that there's a debate about the extent of the mandate, I just want to observe as kind of a layman, as an engineer, not a theologian, that taken plainly, this mandate must mean something. And taken plainly, it at least means that we are supposed to have a dominion over the animal kingdom. And probably it means more than that. But I think it's obvious that it means at least that. Now, what's the point? For those of us in science and engineering, this is literally true. This is my vocation. Many of us that are in science and engineering see our personal calling rooted in this verse. Does God actually call people to be scientists and engineers? Is that a worthy way to spend your life? This gets at the heart of why BJU exists, why we offer majors in subjects like science and engineering. See, I personally find my vocation in this verse. You might say, well, that's not me. That's your vocation. That's not my vocation. But consider with me what God told Adam in Genesis 2:15. This is where the word God took man and put him in the Garden of Eden, and he told him to dress it and to keep it. And this is familiar territory to most of you. Pre-fall Eden is not a place where you sit around playing video games or reading books or Facebooking with your friends. From the very beginning, and this is pre-fall, there's work to be done. Adam is given a vocation. His vocation is caretaker of Eden. Now, this is Adam, and I think in the context, it's obvious that this is much broader than just Adam. Because if Adam is given dominion over the whole world, he is not going to be able to do that personally. I would argue that Adam probably can't personally tend even the entire Garden of Eden. And that's why he's given another mandate that we didn't read. But you remember what else God told Adam and Eve? Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Because that's the only way you're actually going to be able to have dominion over a planet as big as this planet. What I'm arguing is that we as mankind collectively are called to be stewards of the natural world. Dress it and keep it implies a care and a concern that are at the heart of a biblical view of the environment. This could be the topic of a whole session, but I want to say that if we want to teach the next generation to handle environmental issues biblically, we start right here in Genesis 1, where dominion includes the privilege of dominion and also the responsibility of dominion. I'm arguing that mankind has a vocation, that mankind has a vocation to be stewards of the earth. That's how we see science first in the Bible as something that we have dominion over. But let's go ahead to point B. And this has been covered well today. We see creation as revelation. Dr. Ormiston took us to Romans 1, and Paul says there that the wrath of God falls on all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men. And I sometimes tell my students that the word that skeptics stumble over in that verse is the word all. We don't have problems with the idea that God is mad at certain people. The Hitlers, the Osama bin Ladens, the Saddam Husseins. If God is mad at anybody, he probably ought to be mad at them. If there's a hell, those kind of people maybe ought to go there. But the suggestion that God is mad at any unrighteousness, any ungodliness, anywhere in the world, including in my own heart, in my own life, that really troubles skeptics. And some of them might say, that doesn't sound fair to me. How can God be angry at people who don't know anything about him? And I think Romans 1:20 is an answer to that question that Paul knows that readers will have. You're telling me it's not fair for God to be angry at people who don't know him, and your thinking is flawed because actually everybody knows God. Everybody knows at least a little bit of something about God, and the way they know that is through his creation, through the things that he made. And Paul tells us two things very pointedly that we can know about God just by looking at creation. One is his power. It ought to be obvious to anyone looking at the world that there's somebody or something out there that is superhuman, that is way more powerful than you and I. It was not a being like you or me that created the universe. It was something infinitely more powerful. That ought to be obvious. And then his Godhead. And the way that I like to think about that, if there's a being out there that's way more powerful than any human is, then guess who's in charge? Guess who rules the universe? Guess who's in the position of God? Guess who's going to be have to accountable to who here? He's God and not me. I think Paul is saying those two things ought to be obvious to anybody in the world. And strikingly, he says, that leaves people without excuse. So science becomes an important channel of what we call general revelation. And then Jason also took us to the famous Psalm 19:1, where we add a third thing to the list. It's the power of God, it's the deity of God, and it's the glory of God. And isn't that true? Isn't that something that we just marvel over as we look at God's creation? Of course it's fallen. Of course there are things about this world that are not good. But there is a majesty, there is a greatness, there is an evidence that there is a good God, that there is a wise God, that there is a God that cares about things like beauty. There's a glory to God that we can see just by looking at his creation. And Jason also covered this, but I think it's fascinating that Psalm 19 also gives us the limits of general revelation. And this becomes an important part of a science worldview. If nature reveals God to me, then why do I need church? Why can't I just go enjoy God and learn God in nature? And the answer, of course, is in verse 7, the law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. And Dr. Ormiston told us how the name for God changes there. In verse 1, the heavens declare the glory of Elohim. It's a general word for God. They tell us that there's a God up there. But if I could say it this way, they don't tell us his name. It's the law of the Lord. It's Yahweh. It's Jehovah. It's his book. It's his law that will convert your soul, that will make you wise, that will change your life. Nature alone is not going to do that. So we had number one, creation is a vocation given to us by God. We have number two, creation is a channel of knowledge. both in general to the whole world and specifically about the glory of God. And now point C, creation is a source of wisdom. And I start with the famous Proverbs 6:6. You know this verse, "Go to the ant, thou sluggard, consider her ways and be wise." And do you understand what Solomon is doing there? He's inviting us to go drop in on a science class. He's inviting us to go investigate nature. He's inviting us to play scientist. And he's suggesting that if you would study nature, it might help to make you a wiser person. And you know there are many examples of this in Proverbs, many appeals to look at nature and learn from nature. There is an everyday wisdom to be gleaned from watching God's universe in action. This carries into the New Testament. Think how many times Christ in his parables uses the natural world, uses plants and animals and the weather and things going on in nature to illustrate spiritual truth. One of my favorite examples is in 1 Kings 4, when we're being told the wisdom of Solomon. And I'm going to read for you. He, Solomon, spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. There's an evidence of a wise man. He can write proverbs, and he can write songs. And then 1 Kings 4 goes on to say, "And he, Solomon, he talked about trees." Trees? "From the cedar tree that is in Lebanon, under the hyssop that springeth out of the wall. He spoke also of beasts, and of fowl, and of creeping things, and of fishes. And there came all people to hear the wisdom of Solomon from all the kings of the earth." This was apparently a centerpiece of Solomon's wisdom. He understood science, and he was able to freely draw from the natural world his proverbs and some of his wisdom. You can see this all the way through what we call the wisdom literature. In the book of Job, Job is full of science. In the book of Ecclesiastes, there are repeated references to the natural world, and that being a part of the wisdom that's tried to communicate in that book. One of my favorite examples actually comes from the book of Job, and it's listed on your notes, but it takes some explanation to understand the context. So I would say that learning diligence from an ant is a pretty simple and practical application of this truth. But this extends to some of the deepest and most profound questions of life. And that's what's going on, as you know, in the book of Job. Job is struggling with what is maybe one of the hardest of all of the questions of life, and that is, why do bad things happen to good people? Why do bad things happen to good people? And Job's friends retort that he's not really a good person. That's the explanation. And Job quickly admits that he's not perfect. He's not claiming to be sinless. But he also argues strongly that his life is legitimately more righteous than many of his contemporaries. He is trying to live a righteous life, and he does have a reputation as a righteous man. And he cannot accept the explanation that this is all because of his sin. And when we get to Job 12:6, Job comes to the thing, honestly, that really bugs us the most. The biggest question is not, why do bad things happen to good people? The question is, why do bad things happen to good people when at the same time good things are happening to bad people? Isn't that what really gets under our skin? If everybody in the world is on the same level, if everybody is suffering, then we're okay with that. But I'm a Christian, and I'm serving God, and I'm doing my best to obey him, and my life is just, my car's broken down, and I can't pay my bills, and I don't have a good job, and I have all these health problems. And across the street is my wicked neighbor, and he's living an openly, ungodly, wicked life. And he's rich, and he's prospering, and he's healthy, and everything seems to be going smoothly for him. How is that fair that bad things are happening to me, who's a righteous man, and good things are happening to evil people? Doesn't that make it doubly difficult to accept? Here's how Job says it: "The tabernacles of robbers prosper, and they that provoke God are secure. Into whose hand," can you believe this? It almost seems like God is blessing them and not me. How do you explain that? Well, the answers to that question are not short and they're not simple. When I preach on this in churches, I often say, ask your pastor after I'm done. I can't answer that question in 5 minutes. There are answers to that question, but they're long and they're profound and they're not really simple. But where I want to go today is to suggest that not one preacher in 1,000 would give the answer that Job gives. Would ever suggest that you look for answers where Job suggests. In this context, having just said, why do wicked people seem to be prospering, seem to have God's blessing? Verse 7, Job says, go ask the beasts, and they will tell you, and the fowls of the air, and they shall tell thee. Ask the beasts and the birds and the fish? Are you kidding, Job? No, Job is not kidding, because they are a God-ordained source of profound wisdom. Not just about how to be diligent like a busy ant, but I'm saying about some of the deepest and most profound questions of life. Job is actually suggesting that if you would seriously consider the natural world and how it operates, that would help you to deal with this really difficult question of life. I'm going to leave you to explore how Job works that out on his own. But the point is that Job turns our attention actually to nature to answer some really profound questions. So I'm saying that creation is a source of wisdom. And we've got one more. And this has been well covered today, but creation is a theological foundation. Years ago, I did a personal topical Bible study to explore this topic. I wanted to know what is the role of creation as a doctrine throughout the rest of Scripture. It really started with this question in my mind: does it matter what you believe about creation? Does it have any impact on the rest of our theology? So I went through the Bible looking for references to creation, looking for why did God bring up creation and why did he bring it up? What point does God try to make when he brings up creation later in the Bible? And that was a great Bible study, and I would recommend it to you. I would recommend that you do that Bible study yourself. The references to creation are many, way too many to talk about today. So what I put in your notes is a short list from a study that we do in one of my classes. I teach a core class called Essential Science, and I talk through this very idea with my students. And I give them a subset of that list of references to creation later in the Bible. And if you would just scan your eyes down that list and look at the topics that creation is connected to in the Bible, we're talking about things like capital punishment and styles of worship and the deity of Christ in response to suffering. And the list goes on and on and on. And in each case, God is connecting up the issue at hand to creation. Let me pick out just one of them to show you by way of example. And it comes from Genesis 9. Genesis 9 is the end of the flood story. Noah and his family have come out of the ark, and God comes down for a personal conversation with Noah. Now, would you stop and reflect on that for a minute? How unusual is that in world history? How many people, even in the Bible, had a one-on-one personal conversation with God? How many people did God show up in their lives and say, I have a personal message for you? Can you put yourself in that situation? If God somehow, I don't want to be sacrilegious about this at all, but if you heard a knock on the door and you opened the door at your house one night and there was God, and he said, I want to talk to you, are you interested in what he's going to say? I would think you would be intensely interested in what he's going to say. And surely Noah is in that situation. And God has a list of things he wants to talk to Noah about. And Genesis 9 is that list. And it's not up on the screen, but the first thing he tells Noah is probably what you would guess would be first on the list. God tells Noah, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. And we've heard those words before. That's what God told Adam and Eve. He's telling Noah, you and Mrs. Noah, you're going to repopulate the world, you and your family. You're like a new Adam and Eve. It doesn't surprise me at all that that's number one on God's list, but number two, I bet you would not have expected. God says, let's have a talk for a minute about those animals, those smelly animals that you've been living with for a year in the ark, that you were maybe happy to just get away from now. We need to talk about the animals. And God says, no, I want to tell you the animals are going to be afraid of you. And the Bible doesn't go into detail, but it sounds like that's a change, that there's a change in the relationship between people and animals at this point in history. God says the animals are going to be afraid of you, and they're going to be afraid of you for a really good reason, because you are going to kill them and eat them for food. That's a reason to be afraid. Animal rights has become an important issue in our contemporary culture. Many people, even many religious people, argue that there's something wrong with the idea of killing animals and using them for food. Well, if you've read Genesis 9, the Bible answer is very, very clear. I say it in these words: the God who created those animals gave us permission to kill them and eat them for food. That is the Bible answer. But God also wants to make it very clear that there is a strict limit to this permission to kill. And that's why we have the next verse. Whoever sheds man's blood, that's different. I just gave you permission to kill animals, but you do not have permission to kill people. If you do that, if you shed a man's blood, then here's the penalty. You will die. By man, by human government, your blood will be shed. This is capital punishment. Here we have another contemporary topic that's debated even among Christians. Is capital punishment right? Is it ever right to kill another human? Genesis 9, God says absolutely. In the case of murder, that is the appropriate punishment for murder. Now, all of that is the background to this. Tell me why. Why is it okay to kill animals for food, but it is a horrible crime to kill another human being? And you know the answer. God himself explains. If you kill a man, we're going to shed your blood because people are made in the image of God. And the implication is the animals aren't. They're different. They're different from people. That's why it's okay to kill animals. That's why it's not okay to kill people. Now, the image of God is a pretty complicated topic, and that's not my point today to explore that. But it is the theological foundation for the limits on what we call animal rights. And it is the deep and profound explanation for the respect for human life that is a part of the Bible worldview. When God wants to explain capital punishment, he takes our thoughts back to creation. Capital punishment is wrong because of the way that I created mankind. This is just one example. We could take an hour or two going through all the examples on the list and many more. But just to mention a couple of them quickly, the Ten Commandments, we've heard this twice. Keep the Sabbath. Why? Because that's the way God created the world back in the beginning. Do you want wisdom as a young person? Ecclesiastes 12:1, remember your Creator in the days of your youth. Have you ever thought about why God said it that way? He didn't just say, remember God as a young person. That would be really good advice. But he makes it really personal and really specific. And he says, if you're a young person and you want to be wise, why don't you meditate on this? Why don't you meditate on your Creator? That's Ecclesiastes 12:1. 1 Peter 4:19, are you suffering? Do you need help to know how to deal with the suffering that you're going through? Well, here's Peter's advice. You need to commit the keeping of your soul to God. That's really good advice. That's fairly obvious advice. That's easy advice to say when you're not the person suffering. You just need to trust God. You just need to turn the situation over to God. You just need to commit everything to God. That's hard advice to take when you're the person suffering. That's what's so hard. How can I trust God when I'm suffering? And that's not the end of Peter's advice. Do you know the rest of that verse? Commit the keeping of your soul to God as unto a faithful Creator. Why does Peter say it that way? Because he thinks that reflecting on God as your creator will actually encourage you in a time of personal suffering. Can I tell you one more that I didn't put on the list, but it's one of my favorites, and then we'll quit with this. On your list is 1 Kings, where Hezekiah prays, and he's just been challenged by the Assyrian army. Your God's not going to deliver you. Did the other pagan gods deliver their nations? No, and your God's no different. He's not going to deliver you either. And Hezekiah goes before God and he prays, and this is what he says. He says, God, you are the God, you alone, of all the kingdoms of the earth. He's asserting that all of the pagan gods are wrong, that Jehovah, Yahweh, is the one true God. And I ask myself as a reader, okay, Hezekiah, what is it about Jehovah that makes him different than all the other gods? And Hezekiah is going to tell you, you are the God, thou alone, of all the kingdoms of the earth, because you made the world. And I tell my students, when I read that, it always reminds me of the story of Jonah. Do you remember the story of Jonah? God says, go to Nineveh and preach. And Jonah says, no way. I don't like those people. I'm not going to go there. So he gets on a boat. He goes the wrong way. God sends this giant storm. The sailors are terrified. This is beyond normal storms, and they're afraid they're going to die. And Jonah tells us that the sailors are crying out to their gods. Jonah doesn't tell us what their religion is. We don't know exactly what god they're praying to, but you can guess. If you have some familiarity with those pagan cultures, those polytheistic cultures, they tended to have a god over every part of the world. There's a god of fertility, there's a god for farming, there's a god of the weather, there's probably a god of the ocean. These sailors are probably praying to some god that they imagine is ruling over the ocean, and it's not working. Their prayers are not working, their sailor skills are not working, they're afraid they're going to die. So they figure out that this is Jonah's fault, and they wake up Jonah, and they say to Jonah, who are you, and where did you come from, and what god do you serve? And do you know what Jonah told them? He said, I serve the God that made the ocean. That's the way he said it. I serve the God that made the ocean. And Jonah records that when he said that, the sailors were exceedingly afraid. You just got which God mad at us? You're telling me not just there's a God that rules over the ocean, there's a God that made the ocean, and you got that God mad at us? We are in big trouble. And that's why they're willing to throw him overboard. So we could go on and on with this. It's really a great study. I would recommend it to you. Just keep your eyes open as you read through the Bible. Look at every time there's a reference to creation or the Creator, and ask yourself, why did God just bring that up? And you're going to see what we've been hearing from every speaker today, that creation is foundational to the rest of our theology. All right, so in conclusion, I want to go back to the title of the session, because they titled this Science, Scripture, and the Church. And I hope you can see how the Scripture embraces science and uses it powerfully as a foundation for a biblical worldview. But what's the connection to the church? And I would simply reference here 1 Timothy 4:15, where Paul tells Timothy that the church is so important because it is the pillar and the ground of the truth. And I ask you, does this aspect of the truth come through in your pulpit? Or are you afraid of science? Are you ignorant of science? Are you apathetic about science? Is your worldview a little bit warped in this area? And is your church failing the next generation by not communicating to them a proper biblical view of the role of science in our world? Can you embrace that the heavens declare the glory of God? That through the study of nature, we actually gain important wisdom? That we have a divinely appointed responsibility to be good stewards of creation? That creation is threaded through our entire theology. To me, that's the way forward, not to run from science, not to fear science, not to see science as the enemy that we have to constantly do battle against, but to revel in the wonders that modern science reveals about the created world. To revel in the resulting mystery that over and over again leads us back to the Creator for answers. So let me make this very practical. Friday night, there was a beautiful snow moon, they call it. And coincidentally, on that same night, there was a partial lunar eclipse. Did you notice? Did you even know it was happening? Did you give God glory for the show he put on for us Friday night? Fast forward in your mind to Monday, August 21st. Do you know that Monday, August 21st, is the biggest day in astronomy this year? Maybe of this decade. Maybe of your lifetime. Because we are going to have a total solar eclipse overtop Greenville on that day. It's going to be a big event on campus. We're going to open campus early. We're going to invite the students to come back early. It's going to be a big day. You do your homework, and believe me, you don't want to miss it. But do you know how important it is that the sun is 400 times bigger than the moon, but it's also 400 times farther away? So that the sun and the moon are the same size in the sky. So that the moon can move over top of the sun and we can have a total solar eclipse. This is hard to understand if you're not an astronomer, but our science would be crippled if we didn't have a moon just the right size to cover up the sun and make an eclipse. We would also miss out on one of the most awe-inspiring things that happens in astronomy. Is that coincidence that we have a moon like that? Or is there some divine design there? And my little astronomy question is a test. Because I started this talk with the question, how does science fit in your worldview? So what are you thinking as I'm talking about the eclipse and the snow moon and the lunar eclipse? Is that interesting to you at all? Does that register with you at all? Or are you sitting there saying, I don't care about that. That's not interesting to me. That's not important to me. That's what I'm saying. Maybe there's a problem about our worldview. Do you know that dinosaurs are really cool? And that God made them? I meet people that are afraid to talk about dinosaurs, that think they're a figment of evolutionist imagination. And boy, are they missing the point. I love to talk to students about dinosaurs. Did you know that the Ice Age is really, really interesting? And that Job might have lived through it? That you can actually fit that in the Bible and it makes sense and it actually explains some things? We are missing a huge opportunity to prepare our students for battle if we make them afraid of science, if we leave them ignorant of science, if we fail to communicate to them that science shows us the glory of God.